From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump receives an update on Operation Warp Speed. That's his effort to develop a coronavirus vaccine. The president hasn't spoken publicly in a week, and he still hasn't conceded the election.
And last night on MSNBC, Joe Biden's incoming chief of staff, Ron Klain, said the delay in the transition of power could affect vaccine development.
We're doing our jobs. The transition is moving ahead. The American people saw this in public this week, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris doing their jobs. But as time passes, the need to get the full access we are entitled to and the full access that the American people want us to have, it grows each day.
Our Friday roundtable joins us now. Aisha Roscoe is White House reporter for NPR. Hi, Aisha. Good to have you back.
Hello.
And Olivia Nuzzi is Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Hi, Olivia.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And Olivia, let's start with you. Why the silence from the Trump administration and from the president himself? I know you've written an article titled The Final Gasp of the Trump Presidency. What are you hearing?
Well, what I'm hearing is that it's a few different things. There are some friends and advisors of the president who think that he is, as we would expect, humiliated by defeat. Being a loser is obviously something that Donald Trump never wanted to be. It's an insult that he lobs at people frequently. And other people who think that, you know, he really did not enjoy being president, even if he enjoyed the status that it brought him. Even if he enjoyed seeming like a winner. And he's dragging this out because it's dramatic and he doesn't want to appear like he's going down without a fight. But the silence from him is obviously uncharacteristic. We see him on Twitter a bit retweeting right-wing activists, retweeting right-wing media hosts. But we have not heard from him in person. He has avoided the press. And this is obviously not what we have come to expect from Donald Trump. And so it makes me think that perhaps he genuinely is crushed by the defeat on an emotional level, or perhaps he is unsure of what to do. I mean, this is kind of what defined the last stretch of the campaign to me as an observer, as someone who has covered Donald Trump for years now, was that the president, based on all of my interviews and my reporting, seemed to be genuinely unsure of how to act, what to do, what to think. He wasn't sure if he should trust his yes men anymore. And I think that he seems as uncertain now. That's what the silence is suggesting to me.
Yeah. Aisha, what are you hearing? Is the president getting closer to acknowledging the truth that he's lost? I mean, I'm sure you saw today that Trump advisor Peter Navarro said publicly on TV that they're preparing for a second term.
Yeah, it doesn't seem at this point that the president is acknowledging that, you know, that he lost, the reality that is there. What we've been hearing is sort of hints. You had, you know, Geraldo Rivera tweeting today saying that he talked to President Trump and that President Trump is willing to concede that he lost, but he wants to wait until states certify their results and wait until there's actually maybe an electoral college outcome. None of that is going to change the reality, which is that President Biden that Vice President Biden is now President-elect Biden. That's not going to change. But you see this kind of almost, you know, maybe an emotional thing that Trump is going through. This is one of the longest periods, definitely of this year, where President Trump has gone without talking answering questions. And it is one of the longest stretches of his presidency where he has not made public remarks.
Olivia, even though the president may be saying that he wants to wait until states certify the results, there are a handful of Republicans who are saying that the president should begin the transition and do the traditional things such as share intelligence briefings with Joe Biden. There's also talk that Donald Trump could announce a 2024 election run soon. The New York Times reports it could happen as soon as Joe Biden is certified as the winner. If that does happen, if President Trump wants to make another run, what effect could that have on other members of his party? And I wonder if you think it could embolden some and silence others.
Well, it's interesting. I was sort of expecting, perhaps naively, right after the election, for more Republicans to distance themselves from Donald Trump for months prior to the election. Some people in Washington certainly seem to be preparing for a post-Trump era. And the president, he himself started to admit that he might lose in July after the disastrous Tulsa rally. That was an embarrassment to him because not enough people showed up, or certainly not as many people as the campaign had advertised. And some people ended up getting, there was a spike in coronavirus cases in Tulsa after that rally. And he started to acknowledge the reality of what the polls were saying back then in July. But publicly, of course, he never admitted that. And even as he inched closer to Election Day, and there were some suggestions from him that, you know, I heard him at rallies saying, if we win, which seemed to be a departure from how he had been speaking previously, he was not openly preparing for a loss. And I think now, you know, he's preparing for a second act, and the implications for the party, I think, is that it becomes more complicated to define what they are with Donald Trump out of the White House. You see some Republicans continuing to back him up after John Jr. tweeted wondering where the 2024 contenders were defending him. People seem to spring into action. You saw Nikki Haley and others coming out to defend him. But there are many Republicans who, you know, want the party to return to something approaching normalcy. But it's not clear what that will look like if Donald Trump continues to loom over everybody and kind of take up all the oxygen as he has since 2015.
And still holding the levers of power as well. Aisha, the president has been firing some people at the Pentagon, also apparently according to the Washington Post today, at Homeland Security as well. Is the Joe Biden transition team concerned about this kind of thing?
Well, they're not saying that they're publicly that they're concerned. They are doing what they can at this point. Obviously, you know, Joe Biden has said, look, there's one president at a time. We're going to do what we can. But you do see them starting to say, you saw Ron Klain give an interview where he raised concerns about how not having that legal transition happening, not them not being allowed into agencies, et cetera, how that could affect their handling of the coronavirus and the rollout of the vaccine, which needs to be seamless, but they're not being allowed in at this point. So I think there are questions about what is going on and concern from outsiders looking in about what is going on at the Defense Department and how is national security being dealt with within the Defense Department when this is a very critical time when you have people, adversaries of the U.S. are looking and they could see a moment to try to do something because they see that there's tension or weakness because there's so much upheaval.
Yeah, Aisha, sticking with you for just a minute. As you say, the incoming Biden administration is trying to get to work, but already they're facing questions about whether the president-elect would enact some form of shutdown after one of his coronavirus medical advisors said this week that it would be effective. And Republican governors are already pushing back on Biden's call for national mask mandates. Here's Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts this week.
Steph, President-elect Biden is indeed confirmed to be the next president, and he approaches me about a mask mandate. I would not be going along with a mask mandate.
How tough is it going to be for Joe Biden to forge consensus on the coronavirus when he finally gets to work?
It's going to be tough because it's become a very political issue. But you have seen some Republican governors, as things have worsened in their states and in prior surges where things worsened in their states, where they have gotten more strict about mask wearing or where they have taken more proactive action when it comes to mask wearing. But at this point, it is very political. So it's not going to be something where Biden's just going to be able to come in and he'll have his mask on and everyone will just go along with it. It's going to be a test of the new administration, how they can try to, you know, push or cajole or try to get states to move along with what they're trying to do when it comes to the coronavirus. Part of that may be, unfortunately, the pressure that these states will feel on the ground and how bad it gets.
That is the
real life pressure of it.
Yeah, and the other test will be a coronavirus relief package. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this morning.
This is a red alert, all hands on deck. This is an emergency of the highest magnitude. And yet, our Republican colleagues want to focus elsewhere.
Yeah, Olivia, we have just about a minute left here, but what do you think? Can Biden break the impasse on this issue?
I have a hard time seeing that. I think the trends of negative partisanship that really started in retaliation to the election of the first black president that got worse, that got Donald Trump elected, are going to make it very, very difficult for Joe Biden to bring people together, which has been his pitch all along. I have a hard time seeing Republicans wanting to work across the aisle with the Biden administration.
Yeah. Olivia Nuzzi, Washington correspondent for New York Magazine, and Aisha Roscoe, White House reporter for NPR. It's a pleasure to have both of you on today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Christopher John Toomey grew up in Auburn, Maine. People called him CJ. He loved the Red Sox, serving in the Air Force, and his family. He made this little video for his mom.
Hey there. Was just thinking about how wonderful you are. I want to say how fantastic you are. And how I'm going to miss you when I go to Afghanistan. I love you, Mama!
CJ was recruited for Air Force Special Operations, but he didn't make it. Many don't. So the fun-loving young man with the blue eyes and the big smile was home with his parents and younger brother, and he was drinking a lot. They didn't realize he was suffering from depression. One day, in a snap second, CJ took his life. But his story didn't end there. Far from it. What's transpired in the 10 years since, no one could have predicted. It's the subject of a documentary from Spark Media called Scattering CJ. Hallie Toomey is CJ's mother. We want to warn you that she speaks openly here about how her son killed himself and the moments that led up to his suicide.
You know, it's still a little bit confusing. There was a lot of drama that last day. We had had an argument. He had said he was going to definitely go back into the military and then called me at work, and everything had changed sort of out of the blue. And I just said, stay there. I'm going to come home and talk to you. And I came home and we had a very heated discussion in the kitchen. I remember thinking he was just being overly dramatic. And, you know, he was very insistent he had no hope and no future. And we had had fights before, just like any parent with any child. And, you know, his last words to me were, "You think I'm a failure, don't you?" And when I didn't respond, he said, "Failure, I'll show you failure." And just a few moments later, he went out in front of our house and jumped in his car. And then he shot himself in front of my husband and myself. So, you know, in hindsight, maybe there were signs, but we didn't see them at the time.
I'm sure that's very hard to recall and give voice to again. And I know for some listeners, it's very hard to hear as well. We just want to make this note that we think it's important to talk about, because suicide can sometimes be impulsive, especially when there's access to a gun. It can be more lethal. You say that you turned the house upside down looking for a suicide note so you can get clues to what led up to his death. You didn't find one. And for 3 years, you grieved, and you would see the urn that held CJ's ashes. In the documentary, and this is the amazing thing, you said this couldn't be the end of his journey. You had an idea. Could you briefly tell us what that was?
As you said, I had seen the urn every single day, and it just seemed like my bigger-than-life son, who just enjoyed adventure and traveling. It just didn't seem like the right ending. So I asked my husband one day if he thought it would be crazy to ask friends or friends of friends if they might be willing to take a little bit of CJ's ashes on their travels and just scatter some of his ashes. So we put that request out on Facebook, and it ultimately went viral and led to where we are today.
And Hallie, as part of the request, you asked people to write to you telling you where they were scattering the ashes and to take a picture as they did it. And as you said, you got a huge response and a really heartwarming response. Let's listen.
I'm Anna, and this is my husband, Nav.
We're here today at the Great Pyramid of Giza to scatter CJ's ashes.
DJ, your mom loves you very much.
I'm here for DJ.
Alec, here's CJ. I'm taking scuba diving. We're going to go up the Great Barrier Reef, and we're going to do it right now. Woo!
So there were people who scattered his ashes in the Great Barrier Reef, at the Great Wall of China, at the Olympics, at Mount Kilimanjaro. Some of his ashes went up into space, and a little bit closer to home, his beloved Fenway Park, because he loved the Sox. I want to go now to Andrea Kalin, who is director of the film Scattering CJ. Andrea, how did you hear about Hallie and CJ's story, and at what point did you enter the family's journey?
I saw a picture of CJ, this smiling, beautiful young man with a Red Sox t-shirt. And it was in an article a colleague who's in London sent to me. And then I was wondering, how did a picture of a young man with a Red Sox tee end up in London and people are commemorating his passing? I was just really struck how when the Toomeys shared their story, it became like a collective heartbeat. Hallie speaks so openly and bravely and vulnerable, and she makes, you know, others feel that they're not beyond help. And I think they find strength in her story.
One of the most affecting scenes, I think, is of Hallie sitting at the dining room table with CJ's ashes. And maybe, Hallie, you can describe how you went about doing this. You had the urn with his ashes. You had a little, looks like maybe a quarter or half teaspoon. You would place them in small, clear plastic bags, mail them off with a picture of CJ to people around the world. And you specifically wanted them to say something as they scattered his ashes. What was it?
I asked them to let him know that he was loved, that his father, his mother, and his brother loved him, but most specifically that I'm sorry. The guilt I have felt for 10 years over missing what I think I still think I should have seen, or the lack of help that I think I didn't give him. I needed him to hear from the universe or whoever would participate that I'm sorry, very sorry. And not a single offer or a single scattering has been more important than another. The offers that have come across from, you know, a woman in central portion of the United States and just said, I don't have much to offer you. I know he's gone to the Egyptian pyramids and the Great Barrier Reef, but I have a backyard. I run a daycare. And all I can promise you is that every day, CJ will be kept company by laughter and smiles and happiness. It's pretty much guaranteed because of this journey and because of the kindness of others that anywhere that I travel on this vast planet, I would not be very far from my son. And that is breathtaking.
Hallie, I think it's an important point, and I'm really glad that you brought that out, because in the years that we covered you and the family, I always felt it wasn't the places that CJ went, it's the people who took him there. And it's that kindness that absolute strangers showed that is so moving and that has really helped your family and helped you heal.
Absolutely.
There was a different kind of response as well, and we can hear it in this clip now from an Ohio resident named April and her teenage son, Xander, who say CJ's story brought them closer together.
I was able to tell him everything about my attempted suicide and my depression.
When my mom told me about CJ, it made me cry. When she asked me why I was crying, I said, because these could be your ashes that I'm spreading. There's been times where I just want to collapse in my bed and give up, but I think of CJ and it carries me on to, like, I can do this today.
Hallie, when you hear sentiments like that from people who have family members who've tried to take their lives or people who have tried to take their own lives, does it seem heartening or odd or maybe both to you that your son's suicide has given people hope?
It's difficult. I mean, suicide is a horrific beast. It changes everything. And to know that somebody chooses to not follow in CJ's footsteps, or that families can actually have open communications and conversations around what this really means, what life would be like if their loved one wasn't there. It makes me really believe that this purpose, this intent that I have to share openly and honestly is a good thing.
Is there a time you can point to when you thought, Hallie, you know, I think we're going to make it as a family?
I don't think I ever doubted we would make it as a family. I certainly struggled very openly for a lot of years. I have been very honest. I've never been actively suicidal, but I've been so lost that I thought, you know, I will never not feel grief or sorrow until I'm gone. But I think watching how proud I was of Connor and John, who are such introverts.
And Connor and John are your son, Connor, and your husband, John.
Yes. And they're, you know, Connor is mini John and CJ was mini me. And just being so proud of their willingness to open up. You know, we grieve very differently. We're just different people. And I don't doubt that our family as a collective threesome, which we never asked to be, will always be united, and we've grown stronger because of this. And I also know that I'm very lucky because I've met many people who didn't survive. Their family unit did not survive. And although I feel very unlucky in losing my child, my firstborn, my beloved CJ, I am very lucky that I have my husband and my son, Connor.
And we should say you and your husband are high school sweethearts.
We are, yeah. We've been together.
Even more amazing that you're still together.
Yes. We'll be celebrating 30 years of marriage next year and 35 years together.
Congratulations.
It's something. Thank you.
Hallie Toomey and Andrea Kalin, very nice to talk to you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa, for having us.
Thank you very much.
Ultimately, people scattered CJ's ashes in more than 1,000 locations around the world. The film Scattering CJ will be available for free online screenings starting tonight through November 21st. The 21st is International Survivors of Suicide Loss Day, and the filmmakers will hold a live virtual event with conversations and clips from the film. If you or someone you know would like to speak with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, the number is 1-800-273-8255. You can find more on the event and other suicide resources at hereandnow.org.
American investors soon won't be able to put money into dozens of Chinese companies. President Trump signed an executive order yesterday barring investment in 31 companies that the Trump administration says have ties to the Chinese military. Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
And let's dig into this executive order here. What Chinese companies are affected and why is Trump banning them?
Well, as you said, it's 31 companies in total. That includes several in the aerospace and aviation industries. There's others in the chemical and communications industries. Probably the most well-known is the cell phone manufacturer Huawei. But another really important one is China Mobile Communications Corporation. They control the main cell phone carrier in China that has almost a billion, with a B, subscribers. So a very huge, important company in China. And the reason, Peter, the executive order basically says that Trump believes these companies are exploiting the U.S. capital markets to enable the development of their military and other security operations, and that they believe this directly threatens the U.S. and U.S. state forces overseas, Peter.
Yeah, the order takes effect on January 11th. Let's just do the math here. That's 9 days before Joe Biden gets the keys to the White House. Why is Trump doing this at the 11th hour when he appears, frankly, to be not much of anything else?
Yeah, so I haven't seen any statements or even tweets from Trump about this. I wouldn't want to speculate on what he's thinking, but obviously Trump has been very aggressive towards China with a goal of sort of decoupling the Chinese and U.S. economies. And when it comes to the Biden transition, it's clear Trump's not really extending any courtesies to the incoming administration or even conceding that he lost yet. So he doesn't seem to really be doing anything to smooth the way for Joe Biden, let's say. And perhaps this could be seen as a way to sort of put Biden on the spot when he gets in after the inauguration to force him to sort of determine how he wants to handle this type of situation with China.
What's Chinese What's China's government saying, and have we heard from any of the companies?
So the Chinese Foreign Ministry responded. They basically called it a vicious slander, and they said it severely harms the rights and interests of Chinese companies, as well as foreign investors, including U.S. investors. Interestingly, the Chinese ministry, foreign ministry, actually congratulated Joe Biden on the win today for the first time. So whether right. that's a coincidence or not, who knows?
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Huawei. They'd already been dealing with tough sanctions that the Trump administration had imposed on them earlier this year. It's a big, important company. So how much more does this hurt them, and also the whole tech world?
Yeah. So with Huawei, they are somewhat less affected by this order simply because they are not a public company with a stock that trades around the world. So they're not sort of at the whims of international investors who would have to be forced to sell, or U.S. investors, rather. But I think those other sanctions you talk about that basically prohibit chips and materials to be sold to Huawei are a much bigger deal to the bottom line, Peter.
Yeah. All right. We'll keep an eye on this as it develops. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Good to speak with you as always. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you, Peter.
Many young immigrants around the country took a deep breath and relaxed for the first time in 4 years when Joe Biden won the election. The president-elect has already promised to extend DACA, the Obama-era program that has allowed young immigrants brought to the country illegally as children to stay and work in the United States. President Trump has spent years trying to overturn it, and for Reyna Montoya, it was a personal attack. She came to Arizona from Mexico with her family when she was a girl. She's now 29, a DACA recipient, and founder of the immigrant advocacy group Aliento. We met up to talk about the election outside a coffee shop in Phoenix.
So you've had about a week to process the results of this election. How are you feeling?
It's a lot of mixed emotions being here in Arizona. We led a huge campaign where we mobilized 25,000 young and Latinx voters. So definitely feel a lot of pride seeing the Latino and the Latinx voter turnout increase, and also the young voter increase. So definitely, I also feel relieved the fact that President-elect Biden is already making statements that he's going to reinstate the DACA program on day one. But also a lot of mix of emotions about if he's going to follow through with his commitment.
Yeah, so relief. And I'm sure that's quite a different feeling than you had, say, over the last 4 years when the Trump administration has tried very hard to erode those protections. How does it compare?
The past 4 years have been very difficult, especially as a DACA recipient. From the beginning of the administration, I remember there was a leak coming from the administration saying they were going to have the DACA program rescinded. I think it was early February of 2017. And then from there, it became all this litigation that, for me, what it meant as a DACA recipient was waking up constantly at 5 a.m. in the morning, having to check my Twitter, 9 p.m. on Fridays to see if he was going to drop another executive action, and then having to monitor the whole case from the lower courts all the way through the Supreme Court. So definitely it was a lot of stress to having to endure that. And even this year, that meant that now I have to renew my work permit every year instead of every 2 years.
And that was a result of the Supreme Court telling the Trump administration it couldn't end DACA. But then the Trump administration decided to force people like you to renew every single year, to make it more complicated.
That's 100% accurate.
Well, and so here you are in Arizona, in this surprise battleground state, a DACA recipient.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't vote in this election, although it sounds like it didn't stop you from being active in it. What was that experience like to turn this state blue?
I think for us, it has never been about turning the state blue or red. And maybe because I grew up in Arizona and Arizona is home, it's more about the policies and making sure that the people who have been marginalized for so long, or people who feel that they don't have a voice like me because we don't have an opportunity to vote yet, can still be part of the political process. Because at the end of the day, whoever gets elected, it's going to impact our lives, from DACA to immigration to education. So for me, it was really important that we have young people being educated on the matter, and that we're not saying that young people don't care or they're apathetic.
Do you feel like you made a difference, like you personally? helped win this state?
I would definitely say that I made a lot of a difference. I talked to my cousin who was voting for the first time. She didn't even know how the ballot looked, and she was having all these questions like, what are propositions? What are school board elections? So I had to really break it down for her. I talked to a lot of my extended family that have an opportunity to vote. I talked to first-time voters. We actually ran a whole operation on Election Day and before that, but on Election Day, I still have the memory when I was preparing some of our young people to be trainers, and then they told me that in one of the phone banks, they talked to an 18-year-old who was going to be voting for the first time, and they said 2 hours before the polls closed, the voter didn't know that it was Election Day. Mm. So it's about getting young people to be educated on the matter and to make sure that they're exercising their power to vote, and then the work comes after.
In some ways, your journey really has just started. In other words, there's so much more to do that I'm sure you and your colleagues are going to be pressing the Biden administration for. What are you asking for? What do you need from the Biden administration?
We are hoping that on day one, he reinstates the DACA program, but that's the first step. We need to make sure that the younger Dreamers who didn't qualify for DACA are able to have a pathway to citizenship. As we know, this with this administration now more than ever, we were able to see that how fragile the program is. So we need a permanent solution. We need a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers like me so we can live in peace. But also, as we're talking about COVID-19 and the recovery of the economy, we can't forget that the Latino community was disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. And we cannot forget that 17 million people across the nation were systematically excluded from economic relief of the CARES Act if they had a loved one who was undocumented. So definitely I want to make sure that we are going through a reconciliation process where immigrants are not taken for granted and we don't continue to be a talking point.
But what you didn't get is Congress, essentially. I mean, the House lost some Democrats in this election. We think the Senate didn't flip, depending on the outcome of the runoffs in Georgia. It's not going to be easy to get what you're asking for from the Biden administration. I mean, are you optimistic?
I'm cautiously optimistic,
really?
And I think that the problem here is that
because the gridlock is getting worse.
Yeah, it is getting worse, but that's the thing is, like, at this moment, immigration shouldn't be a red or blue issue. Then I think that this is a snapshot of what could happen. Are we really going to be able to craft solutions that are going to help us all as a nation, as Americans, or are we going to continue with the gridlock where we have Congress continue to not act and not to provide solutions?
The immigrant community was pretty tough on Barack Obama and his administration. Do you think if Joe Biden fails to get DACA, another immigration reform, through, that he's going to feel the criticism and the heat?
Definitely. It hasn't been about, as I said, Democrats or Republicans. It's who can deliver.
The other thing you're facing is that Donald Trump may have lost this election, but he hasn't conceded yet. And 71 million people voted for him. That's a lot of people. So how do you heal a country in a way that would allow those people to come together with Democrats? As you say it's not a blue or red issue, right? How do you get those 71 million people who ostensibly voted against people like you to come to the table and figure out that, you know, you're in the best interest of the country, in your opinion?
It's going to take a lot of tough conversations. I think that here in Arizona, we've been able to do a very good job about coming more to the center when we're seeing that running ultra-partisan campaigns don't work. If we look at the statewide elections, the way that Kyrsten Sinema or Mark Kelly ran their elections, it was about bringing people to the middle and making sure that we have solutions. And I think that that's what's going to have to happen at the Thanksgiving table. If COVID permits, you know, if people are gathering or maybe through Zoom calls or anything, we need to have those conversations about what's at stake, for us, and how do we focus on rebuilding our nation.
It's really interesting to hear you praise the idea of coming to the middle, because a lot of people in the progressive community, which includes a lot of immigrants and Latino voters, you know, would say, we don't need to go to the middle. No, we need to be as strong and as fierce as the right is. It sounds like you're saying the opposite.
I can definitely sympathize with that, and I would want everything that I want to be done, but I think that there's a different world when you're campaigning versus when you're governing. I think that if half of the population feel left out from the conversation, we need to dig deeper. This could not only be about Donald Trump and Biden. It has to be about us. It has to be about how do we make sure that we are leading with equity. And if we're systematically excluding a specific population, we're going to see it reflected from the education level. I get to see that only 22% of Latinos in the state of Arizona have higher education, some sort of higher education. And that is embarrassing.
In the meantime, I assume you feel like you can breathe for the first time in a while, because we know the Biden administration is going to be sympathetic to your cause. What is that like, to just to be able to breathe? How does that change your life?
I mean, honestly, on Saturday when I heard the news, I was sitting in my bed and I had my phone reading the news and my doggies were around me and I just started crying. And it wasn't because I was super excited about a Biden administration. It was that sense of relief that I felt that this big weight off my shoulders have been lifted. And it's sad to see that so much trauma that we have to endure from deportations of loved ones, to constantly living in fear that tomorrow can be the last day that I stay here in my beautiful Arizona. So definitely it's been very difficult, and it was just a huge sigh of relief.
Reyna Montoya, thank you for taking the time to meet me here. It is a beautiful November day in Phoenix, Arizona. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
President Trump is still contesting the 2020 election results, even as most of the country and the world acknowledge that Joe Biden is the winner. When Trump exits the White House, could he re-enter the world of television that made him so famous? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. And Eric, President Trump, of course, staked a lot of his brand on his TV shows and his appearances. He craves the spotlight, we know. How could he parlay that into a post-presidency job?
Well, I think everyone has the sense that Donald Trump likes being in the spotlight. And so the easiest way for him to keep doing that outside the White House would be for him to take a media job somewhere, become a high-profile commentator, for example, for Fox News, or perhaps align himself with one of the smaller conservative-oriented networks like One America News Network or Newsmax TV. And basically turn it into Trump TV, you know, where they would be more or less devoted to talking about him and sort of keeping him visible, particularly if he's actually going to follow through with these rumors that we're hearing that he plans to run again in 2024.
Interesting that you mentioned he could take a job with Fox News, since he's been slamming the network. He did so several times this week. Despite having a pretty close relationship with a lot of its stars, there is a report by Axios this week that Trump actually may go head-to-head with Fox. What do you make of this?
Well, it's interesting. Axios said that Trump was thinking about starting his own digital media platform to directly compete with Fox and take them on. And I find that highly unlikely, because it would take a lot of work and it would also take a lot of money. What we know about Trump from his past business experience is that he much prefers to let someone else build something and then attach his brand to it and try to take credit for the work that they've done. I think it's far more likely that he's going to align himself with an existing media platform. And, you know, Fox News is going to back up the money truck to try and keep Donald Trump from going somewhere else. Eventually, I think the big paycheck and the idea of working with people like Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, who've already, you know, sort of advised him, I got to think that's going to outweigh the daunting prospect of trying to challenge a cable news channel that has dominated conservative media for more than 10 years.
All right. Watch this space, in other words. Eric, I want to bring up another topic in the world of TV. Veterans Day was this Wednesday, and Netflix premiered its new miniseries, The Liberator, Wednesday. It sounds really interesting. It follows a particularly diverse American battalion in World War II. Why don't we listen now to the opening sequence?
On July 10th, 1943, a unit from Oklahoma, composed of Mexican-Americans, Native Americans, and Dust Bowl cowboys, landed in Sicily and began a brutal 500-day trek through Nazi-occupied Europe.
So this is an actual battalion. Do the producers tell their story using historical footage from the war?
Well, actually, what they do is they use this process called rotoscoping, where you film real life scenes, but then you trace over it and you animate it. But I would find this compelling, even if they hadn't chosen to rotoscope it, because it's the kind of story we haven't heard much about. It's a story about people from different ethnic backgrounds uniting. It's a story of how people of color have risen up to defend this nation, even when this nation wouldn't defend them. There's so many elements to this story that are so interesting and compelling that I would be interested in it, even if it wasn't rotoscoped. But, you know, this production technique makes it look even more visually striking and interesting.
I want to play one more scene now. This is where the battalion's translator is held captive in a basement, and he is explaining the diversity in the regiment to his German captor. First, we hear from the captor.
Things must be getting desperate in America, if they're allowing these types into your army. Red men are Mexicans, inferior races.
We don't see them that way. And they're Americans, like me.
Really? I've been to Oklahoma, Corporal, and the bars have signs out front that say, no Indians allowed, no Mexicans. I've also been to Georgia. They make their Negroes there drink from separate water fountains. Don't tell me they're Americans just like you.
That's a really interesting moment because, again, you know, World War II was a real turning point for people of color in America, not just Mexicans and Native Americans, but black soldiers went overseas, fought very bravely, were treated by their European allies more as equals, and then they came back to an America that wanted them to be oppressed again. And they refused to accept that oppression. And that's when we really began to see the seed sown for what would blossom into the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s later. So if you want to sit down with a story that's been undertold about the courage and bravery of American soldiers who fought for America, even when they had every reason to turn their back on the country, this is a great story to check out.
The miniseries is called The Liberator. It debuted on Netflix this week. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
Check in on how some of the countries of Central and South America are reacting to the election of Joe Biden. Also, Barack Obama's new memoir, next time on Here and Now.